Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 6, Chapter 5. While waiting for the announcement of his appointment to the committee, Prince Andrew looked up his former acquaintances, particularly those he knew to be in power and whose aid he might need. In Petersburg, he now experienced the same feeling he had had on the eve of a battle, when troubled by anxious curiosity and irresistibly attracted to the ruling circles where the future, on which the fate of millions depended, was being shaped. From the irritation of the older men, the curiosity of the uninitiated, the reserve of the initiated, the hurry and preoccupation of everyone, and the innumerable committees and commissions of whose existence he learnt every day, he felt that now, in 1809, here in Petersburg, a vast civil conflict was in preparation, the commander-in-chief of which was a mysterious person he did not know, but who was supposed to be a man of genius, Speransky. And this movement of reconstruction, of which Prince Andrew had a vague idea, and Speransky, its chief promoter, began to interest him so keenly that the question of the army regulations quickly receded to a secondary place in his consciousness. Prince Andrew was most favourably placed to secure a good reception in the highest and most diverse Petersburg circles of the day. The reforming party cordially welcomed and courted him, in the first place because he was reputed to be clever and very well read, and secondly because by liberating his serfs he had obtained the reputation of being a liberal. The party of the old and dissatisfied, who censured the innovations, turned to him expecting his sympathy in their disapproval of the reforms, simply because he was the son of his father. The feminine society world welcomed him gladly because he was rich, distinguished, a good match, and almost a newcomer, with a halo of romance on account of his supposed death and the tragic loss of his wife. Besides this, the general opinion of all who had known him previously was that he had greatly improved during these last 5 years, having softened and grown more manly, lost his former affectation, pride, and contemptuous irony, and acquired the serenity that comes with years. People talked about him, were interested in him, and wanted to meet him. The day after his interview with Count Arakchiev, Prince Andrew spent the evening at Count Kochubey's. He told the Count of his interview with Sila Andreevich. Kochubey spoke of Arakchiev by that nickname with the same vague irony Prince Andrew had noticed in the Minister of War's anteroom. "Monsieur, even in this case you can't do without Michael Mikhailovich Speransky. He manages everything. I'll speak to him. He has promised to come this evening." "What has Speransky to do with the army regulations?" asked Prince Andrew. Kochubey shook his head smilingly, as if surprised at Bolkonsky's simplicity. "We were talking to him about you a few days ago," Kochubey continued, "and about your free ploughman." "Oh, is it you, Prince, who have freed your serfs?" said an old man of Catherine's day, turning contemptuously towards Bolkonsky. "It was a small estate that brought in no profit," replied Prince Andrew, trying to extenuate his action so as not to irritate the old man uselessly. "Afraid of being late," said the old man, looking at Kochubey. "There's one thing I don't understand," he continued. "Who will plough the land if they are set free? It is easy to write laws, but difficult to rule. Just the same as now, I ask you, Count, who will be the heads of departments when everybody has to pass examinations?" "Those who pass the examinations, I suppose," replied Kochubey, crossing his legs and glancing round. "Well, I have Pryanichnikov serving under me, a splendid man, a priceless man, but he's 60. Is he to go up for examination?" "Yes, that's a difficulty, as education is not at all general, but..." Count Kochubey did not finish. He rose, took Prince Andrew by the arm, and went to meet a tall, bald, fair man of about 40, with a large open forehead and a long face of unusual and peculiar whiteness, who was just entering. The newcomer wore a blue swallow-tail coat with a cross suspended from his neck and a star on his left breast. It was Speransky. Prince Andrew recognized him at once and felt a throb within him, as happens at critical moments of life. Whether it was from respect, envy, or anticipation, he did not know. Speransky's whole figure was of a peculiar type that made him easily recognizable. In the society in which Prince Andrew lived, he had never seen any one who, together with awkward and clumsy gestures, possessed such a calmness and self-assurance. He had never seen so resolute yet gentle an expression as that in those half-closed, rather humid eyes, or so firm a smile that expressed nothing. Nor had he heard such a refined, smooth, soft voice. Above all, he had never seen such a delicate whiteness of face or hands, hands which were broad but very plump, soft and white. Such whiteness and softness Prince Andrew had only seen on the faces of soldiers who had been long in hospital. This was Speransky, Secretary of State, reporter to the Emperor and his companion at Erfurt, where he had more than once met and talked with Napoleon. Speransky did not shift his eyes from one face to another, as people involuntarily do on entering a large company, and was in no hurry to speak. He spoke slowly, with assurance that he would be listened to, and he looked only at the person with whom he was conversing. Prince Andrew followed Speransky's every word and movement with particular attention. As happens to some people, especially to men who judge those near to them severely, he always, on meeting anyone new, especially anyone whom, like Speransky, he knew by reputation, expected to discover in him the perfection of human qualities. Speransky told Kochubey he was sorry he had been unable to come sooner, as he had been detained at the palace. He did not say that the Emperor had kept him, and Prince Andrew noticed this affectation of modesty. When Kochubey introduced Prince Andrew, Speransky slowly turned his eyes to Bolkonski with his customary smile and looked at him in silence. "I am very glad to make your acquaintance. I had heard of you, as everyone has," he said after a pause. Kochubey said a few words about the reception Arakcheev had given Bolkonski. Speransky smiled more markedly. "The chairman of the Committee on Army Regulations is my good friend Monsieur Magnitsky," he said, fully articulating every word and syllable, "and if you like, I can put you in touch with him." He paused at the full stop. "I hope you will find him sympathetic and ready to cooperate in promoting all that is reasonable." A circle soon formed around Speransky and the old man who had talked about his subordinate Prianichnikov addressed a question to him. Prince Andrew, without joining in the conversation, watched every movement of Speransky's. This man, not long since an insignificant divinity student, who now Bolkonski thought held in his hands, those plump white hands, the fate of Russia. Prince Andrew was struck by the extraordinarily disdainful composure with which Speransky answered the old man. He appeared to address condescending words to him from an immeasurable height. When the old man began to speak too loud, Speransky smiled and said he could not judge of the advantage or disadvantage of what pleased the sovereign. Having talked for a little while in the general circle, Speransky rose and, coming up to Prince Andrew, took him along to the other end of the room. It was clear that he thought it necessary to interest himself in Bolkonski. "I had no chance to talk with you, Prince, during that animated conversation in which that venerable gentleman involved me," he said with a mildly contemptuous smile, as if intimating by that smile that he and Prince Andrew understood the insignificance of the people with whom he had just been talking. This flattered Prince Andrew. "I have known of you for a long time, first from your action with regard to your serfs, a first example of which it is very desirable that there should be more imitators, and secondly because you are one of those gentlemen of the chamber who have not considered themselves offended by the new decree concerning the ranks allotted to courtiers, which is causing so much gossip and tittle-tattle." "No," said Prince Andrew, "my father did not wish me to take advantage of the privilege. I began the service from the lower grade." "Your father, a man of the last century, evidently stands above our contemporaries who so condemn this measure with which merely re-establishes natural justice." I think, however, that these condemnations have some ground, returned Prince Andrew, trying to resist Speransky's influence, of which he had begun to be conscious. He did not like to argue with him in everything and felt a wish to contradict. Though he usually spoke easily and well, he felt a difficulty in expressing himself now while talking with Speransky. He was too much absorbed in observing the famous man's personality. Grounds of personal ambition, maybe, Speransky put in quietly. And of state interest, to some extent, said Prince Andrew. What do you mean? Asked Speransky quietly, lowering his eyes. I am an admirer of Montesquieu, replied Prince Andrew, and his idea that la principe de monarchie le honneur de près incontestable certains droits et privilèges de la noblesse me paraissent être des moyens de soutenir de ce sentiment. In English that translates to that the principle of monarchies is honour seems to be incontestable. Certain rights and privileges for the aristocracy appear to me a means of maintaining that sentiment. The smile vanished from Speransky's white face, which was much improved by the change. Probably Prince Andrew's thought interested him. Si vous envisagez la question sous ce point de vue, he began, pronouncing French with evident difficulty and speaking even slower than in Russian, but quite calmly. That translated to, if you regard the question from that point of view. Speransky went on to say that honour, l'honneur, cannot be upheld by privileges harmful to the service, that honour, l'honneur, is either a negative concept of not doing what is blameworthy, or it is a source of emulation in pursuit of commendation and rewards, which recognises it. His arguments were concise, simple and clear. An institution upholding honour, the source of emulation, is one similar to the Legion d'Honneur of the great Emperor Napoleon, not harmful but helpful to the success of the service, but not a class or court privilege. I do not dispute that, but it cannot be denied that court privileges have attained the same end, returned Prince Andrew. Every courtier considers himself bound to maintain his position worthily. Yet you do not care to avail yourself of the privilege, Prince, said Speransky, indicating by a smile that he wished to finish amiably an argument which was embarrassing for his companion. If you will do me the honour of calling on me on Wednesday, he added, I will, after talking with Magnitsky, let you know what may interest you, and shall also have the pleasure of a more detailed chat with you. Closing his eyes, he bowed à la française, without taking leave, and trying to attract as little attention as possible, he left the room. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. And that final line in the PNV, because it was a bit of a funny line, it said, he closed his eyes and bowed without taking leave, and then without, trying not to be noticed, he left the room. In the other version, it says, he closed his eyes, bowed, and à la française, without saying goodbye, trying not to be noticed, left the room. That seems to make a bit more sense. Who was once delight, said, André attends a soiree hosted by Kochubé, a member of Alexander's liberal reformation-minded committee of public safety. An older guest at the party speaks to the disgruntled feelings of the older nobility over these reforms, noting that writing laws is easy, but governing is difficult. This echoes the statement made in the previous chapter by Arakchiv. Everybody writes regulations these days. It is easier to write them than to follow them. What are your thoughts about these statements? Harvester of Baobab said, I guess that it doesn't matter whether these regulations will work or not. It is a chance for André to meet all the people on the highest steps and to make something. He can take another turn in life now. It's not about his regulations and what they give to military, it's about what they give André. I don't know how much do we know about the nature of these regulations. Maybe I just missed it. Wasn't paying attention when the regulations were explained, but I don't really even know what these changes are about. I mean, I know that the liberal reformers seem to like André now because of what he's done with his serfs. He's liberated his serfs, but I still don't really recall what are the nature of the changes that he wants to make in policy. But Prince Andrei's taken this reform to the right person because he's got this Speransky fellow who is close to Emperor Alexander and is sort of a hero when it comes to Russian liberalism. And according to the Mikhail Speransky Wikipedia page, he was the father of Russian liberalism. I don't know much about this guy, this character, and should probably read his Wikipedia page, but it seems that Andrei's found himself in some very impressive company, and he's managed to make a good impression on this guy as well. Reddit user DeFleury said, "I just liked the line, the smile disappeared from Speransky's white face, which was much improved by the change. My gut reaction to Speransky was to call an exterminator and maybe have them spray for Boris while they're at it. But now I'm going to give him a chance." Turtle Vader responded, "I also got a sociopath vibe from Speransky at first. Funny that him and his cronies are referred to as the Committee of Public Safety when that same title was given to the people rebuilding the government after the French Revolution, which ultimately led to the Reign of Terror and Napoleon." Well, there you go. What does it all mean? I got to confess that when it comes to the politics part of the book, I do seem to slow down a bit. So I'm going to do a bit of reading about this character, this Speransky fellow, and maybe help me build some context about what exactly is going on here. Because I am a little bit lost. But hey, that's what's going to happen in 360-odd chapters. At some point, there's going to be something that confuses you a bit. We'll work through it. Maybe in tomorrow's episode, I'll come back to you with some clarification around that. Now, in the meantime, I've got some pretty good news. Our Podbean subscribers have just passed 100 subscribers, which is a bit of a milestone. I think we've got more than 100 subscribers. We certainly get more than 100 listens per day. I think what this does is just counts the people who subscribe through the Podbean app itself. So it's not counting people who use the RSS feed or the iTunes subscription feed or some different apps. And of course, it's not counting the people who just revisit the page every day and just listen that way rather than subscribing. But still, it ticked over 100, which I thought that's pretty cool. And I figured that might be a good time to announce that I've started up a Patreon page. I was a little bit nervous about that, to be completely honest. I've got this weird hang-up about money things like that. But I was talking to some friends and they said, you know, you've done this for over 100 days in a row and you put hours of effort every day into the podcast. I'm sure that some of your listeners would appreciate it enough to chip in. And so I've launched the Patreon page. And to be completely honest, I do absolutely love the idea of being a podcaster, or at least having podcasting as a permanent part of my life that would sort of fund itself. At the moment, it's sort of a hobby, but a hobby that's taking me an hour or so every single day. I decided that I'd love to put more effort into the podcast, put more hours into it, do interviews, get special research and that kind of thing. And so, of course, if the podcast is generating me some money, then I'm able to do that. So the thing with Patreon is you're completely able to keep listening for free if you want. That's absolutely fine. And I would encourage you to do that. But if you want to show your support and show your thanks and help the podcast to grow, then you can choose to support me as the creator through Patreon. I've got a few different tiers of kind of support that you can choose from. There's one for $1 per month. So that's essentially getting about 30 podcasts for each dollar you spend. And although that seems like very, very little, it does make a huge difference to me to have some support coming in. There's also a tier that's about $30 a month. So you're looking about $1 per podcast. And there's some tiers in between, and there's some bigger tiers as well. There's a really kind of grand tier, the top tier, and that is essentially is what you get is 1 of 100 copies of my new novel when it comes out at the end of the year, signed with a personalized dedication and everything like that. I guess that's my way of saying thanks for supporting the podcast. So if you want to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/ayearofwarandpeacepodcast and make a donation that you feel matches the value of the effort put into this podcast. I'll put a link to that in the description as well. Anyway, that's going to do us for today. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.